that September in the rain. To every word of love I heard you whisper, the raindrops seem to play a sweet refrain. Though spring is here, to me it's still September. That's September in the rain. Came tumbling down, remember, ah, September in the rain. And the sun went down just like a dying ember. That's September in the rain. To every word of love I heard you whisper, and the raindrops seemed to play a sweet refrain. Though spring is here, to me it's still September. That's September in the rain. It's still September.
Call me darling, call me sweetheart, call me dear, thrill me darling with the words I long to hear. In your dark eyes, so smiling, there's a promise I see. But your two lips won't say that you care for me. Oh, my darling.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the special Planning Commission meeting of Monday, November 18th, 2019. I'm calling this meeting to order. And if you would please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We'll start with the roll call of the Planning Commission.
Commissioner Fuller.
Present.
Commissioner Maynard.
Present.
Commissioner Shaler.
Present.
Vice Chair Miller is absent. Chair Smith.
Present. Thank you. Okay, our next item is the public forum. This is an opportunity for any member of the public to speak on an item that is not on tonight's agenda. Do we have any speaker slips for public forum?
No, Chair Smith.
Okay. Anybody from the public wish to speak at this time? I see none, and so I'll go ahead and close the public forum. Do we have any amendments or adjustments to tonight's agenda?
Madam Chair, we do not have amendments or adjustments.
Okay. So we'll start and begin with our administrative agenda.
Thank you. Item A1 is to approve the Planning Commission meeting minutes of Monday, October 28th, 2019.
Okay, do we have any comments or edits from commissioners on the minutes? I see none. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Is that a motion to approve?
Yes, motion to approve.
Okay. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
I have a second. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed or abstentions? None. Thank you. We'll move to our next item.
Item A2 is the Planning Commission meeting schedule for 2020.
Okay. Do we have an update from staff?
Yes. Good evening, Chair and Planning Commissioners. I'll be very brief. This is the annual discussion of the meeting calendar for the upcoming year. Hard to believe it will be 2020 in just a little bit. As indicated in the staff report, there are two dates. Well, this, you know, as you know, Planning Commission meets second and fourth Mondays of each month. The calendar is up on the screen that shows the typical meeting dates following that schedule. Looking at that schedule, we've identified two dates which are marked with the asterisk, the single asterisk, that are dates that City Hall will be closed either for a holiday or during the winter holiday when we're closed. That is Monday, May 25th, which is Memorial Day, and the other will be December 28th. We also have identified three dates that the commission may want to consider canceling meetings. The first is March 23rd. The reason for that is that is during spring break week when all of the local schools, including UCSB, are not in session. So there's a possibility that community members aren't in town during that time period. I seem to have lost my pointer. The next date would be Monday, September 28th. And that date is one of the nights. I think it's Yom Kippur. And then the last one would be October 12th, which is Columbus Day. Columbus Day is not a day that the city is closed as a holiday. It's not a day the city observes, and neither do the schools. So staff is here asking for your to select what days, which holidays you would want to observe. We are at a minimum. I mean, there isn't really anything to do about the May 25th or December 28th, but the question on the other dates. And then if there's other dates that the commission feels that you may want to consider to be closed. We are not at this point in time recommending any cancellations in July or August, and we figured we'd let that see how the calendar plays out with items during the summer months. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's see, Commissioner Sheeler.
Thank you, Chair. Based on projected workload, does this provide staff with enough dates to be able to accommodate your needs and the commission's?
At this point, yes. And I guess if we really need it, we could ask for a special meeting, but at this point, yes.
Commissioner Maynard?
My general preference is always to try to have more dates rather than less dates so we don't have to do the last minute scheduling, because that can be hard, at least for my schedule, so it's better for me to block things out ahead of time. And I note that last year, for some of the ones that we decided to cancel, we ended up going ahead and reserving another date that month. Are there any periods of time, especially if we do cancel some of these additional ones, that we might want to consider holding another date that month so we can still get two meetings in the month? I know we use most of those this year, but that was because we were doing the zoning ordinance. I don't know if we'll need as many next year.
It's possible. I know, like in this month in November, I mean, we ended up because of the way the holidays fell, we were actually looking at canceling. Well, we did cancel both of the regularly scheduled meetings, which is how we ended up with the special meeting this month, actually tonight. So that's how we can. I did not go and look at what dates could be available. And this with, we have, what are we, five, six commissions now in addition to the council. Mm-hmm. So this room is getting very well used. Mm-hmm. So if we were to look at having additional dates, we would need to spend a little bit of time coordinating with the city clerk's office to see when this room might be available. But it is something we can consider if you are interested in us doing that. But at this point mm-hmm. in time, I think we feel that what we have up here is adequate.
And is that if we end up, like, for example, the spring break, Yom Kippur and Columbus Day? Like, I think we shouldn't do Yom Kippur. I'll put that one out there on the 28th of September. But if we cancel those additional ones, does that mean that would create any pinch points for you? I'll defer to staff in the end, but my preference is just not to have as many special meetings that are scheduled later in the process, because if it's better for me to hold time to make sure that I can be there.
The one date that looks like there might be a pinch point is if you look at the September 28th to the if you were to cancel September 28th and October 12th. That could create that problem. If you were not to cancel October 12th, it wouldn't be there would not be an issue.
I'd support keeping the 12th as a meeting that we have one and canceling the 28th.
Yeah, I'd note at least in the report that staff's recommendation is to cancel all the highlighted dates with the exception of October 12th. So that we would, staff recommends keeping October 12th.
Mm-hmm. So we cancel.
Yes.
Madam Chair and Commissioners, I also noticed that November 23rd is the week of Thanksgiving next year, so I don't know if that presents a conflict for us as well. But as Ms. Prossy said, I mean, we'll work around whatever dates are selected.
It's the Monday.
Commissioner Sheeler.
Well, I was going to say the staff recommendation makes sense, but the fact that the 23rd is also on that Monday, I wonder if that's another one that could be canceled in advance.
November 23rd?
Yeah, November 23rd. Leave October 12th and cancel September 28th and March 23rd. And cancel November 23rd.
So just for clarity, so my understanding, staff recommendation is to cancel March 23rd, May 25th, September 28th, and December 28th.
That is correct.
Okay.
And Thanksgiving next year is on the 26th.
So I think
The proposal then was to also add November 23rd as a cancellation?
I think I could support that recommendation for now, and then if staff felt it were prudent to bring back a date, I mean, I know that that's something that would have to be investigated if we needed to add one more.
Okay, I'm sorry. Could you go over which dates we're canceling again, according to the majority so far here?
So the proposal, so this the staff recommendation is to cancel March 23rd. May 25th, September 28th, and December 28th.
Okay, I'm good with that.
Okay, Commissioner Sheeler is also recommending that we cancel November 23rd in light of the Thanksgiving holiday.
I usually go out of town for Thanksgiving, but I could make that. So, I mean, we could try and not schedule anything that day, but or that evening. We've had other meetings that we've canceled, so. But I'm open either way.
And I'd be fine with that also. I was just putting that out there in the event of people whose schedules may not be as flexible as ours. Because basically there is no business occurring from basically Wednesday until Monday.
I usually am in town for the 23rd, so I could make the 23rd work, but I would be concerned about the public being able to be there on the 23rd. So I'm still supporting canceling the 23rd and then just advising staff to look at your own workload and see with that many cancellations, do you feel that we need any special meetings ahead of time? And then whatever your judgment, I would go with it, but just noting my preference to schedule in advance rather than waiting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So am I hearing a motion?
I'll make that as a motion then.
So the motion is to cancel the March 23rd, May 25th, September 28th, November 23rd, and December 28th. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, I'll second that.
Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed or abstentions? I see none. Thank you very much. I guess I'll also just note, I know that Vice Chair Miller isn't present today, so I'll make sure that he gets notified of these dates. Okay, on to our next item.
Item B1 is a public hearing. It's to consider case number 19021 GPA, general plan amendment to include rental housing projects in the housing element inclusionary housing requirements.
Okay, thank you. And this is a public hearing, and in these matters, we typically begin with a staff report. They'll review their report. We'll have any questions from commissioners. And then if we do have any comments from the public, we'll take public comment at that time. We'll then return back to the commission for deliberation and a decision. So I'll start with Ms. Wells.
Good evening, Chair and Commissioners. Jay Ritterbeck, Senior Planner in Advanced Planning, will be giving the presentation tonight.
Thank you, Chair and Commissioners. So, is this on? All right, so I will be beginning with just sort of a background on how we arrived at this point. You probably will recall that during the NZO workshops and the recommendation hearings, there's significant discussion around the topic of inclusionary housing. So we'll give a very brief overview of how we got here, since some of this, if not most, has been discussed previously. In 2009, the Palmer versus the City of LA case really brought this to the forefront, where inclusionary housing requirements, particularly as they related to rental housing, really fell under rental control law, and that was in the Costa-Hawkins Act, which preempted most of the zoning ordinances or general plan policies that cities, jurisdictions had implemented that included that rental inclusionary that was preempted by that other act, because that act allowed a property owner to set what that rental rate should be at that time that they're renting to an individual. So it gave them that authority. So it was all those policies that were trying to enforce a rental inclusionary became obsolete. In August of 2009, the city took out our those policies that included rental inclusionary. We followed suit and we took those out of our general plan in order to become compliant with that ruling, the Palmer ruling. In September of 2017, Governor Brown then signed AB 1505 into law, and then that was signed in order to supersede Palmer, which then again allowed rental inclusionary to be brought in as policy if a city or a jurisdiction chose to do so. Then in October of this year, not too long ago, City Council initiated a general plan amendment which authorized city staff to go in to look to to see where we could integrate that inclusionary housing for rental back in to our general plan. So just some broad background on affordable housing. State law provides that a site that has zoning that allows a density of 20 or more, that those are deemed to be suitable for housing affordability to extremely low, very low, low. Those together are termed, or as a group are considered, a lower income bracket. So when we're talking about lower income throughout the this discussion, we're really looking at those three. Other income categories include moderate and above moderate. And if you look through our general plan, you'll also notice there's some discussion of what we is called workforce housing. That's really a subset of that above moderate, because where above moderate starts, it goes up and it doesn't have a cap. But our workforce housing, it does cap out at 200. So we do an analysis in recognition that we want to, when we're looking at things that are above moderate, we wanted to incentivize creating housing that was really focused on making it affordable for some of our workforce to stay here, which then, you know, feeds into the fewer vehicle miles traveled. And so we wanted to just account for them as well in our general plan. When we look at the next bullet down, we're looking at income limits on affordable housing, and these are based on annual median income. And when we look at that, each county within the state has its own AMI set. That's by HCD. They look at what that smaller locality, countywide, what that median income is there, and that's based upon a four-family household. For Santa Barbara County, you may recognize the this table, where we look at whether at each income level, if the household size is 1 to 8 or more, we look at what we can expect a that average median income to be for that family, that household unit. And then when we're looking, let's see here. So in this example, we'll see in a later example in this this presentation, we'll take as an example a two-person household at that lower or moderate income, and we'll look at what that would look like as far as the housing, the expected prices that that household would have to pay. So state law also defines affordable housing costs for lower household incomes as not more than 30% of their annual median income. As such, when you calculate that out, a two-person household within Santa Barbara County, an extremely low household would be expected to pay an upward maximum of about $478 a month. Very low would be just under $800 a month. Low is about $1,275 a month. Moderate at about $1,911. And then when you go to that workforce housing, that would go up to about $3,185. And if you look through each one of these, that will show you how that's calculated out. And then we also calculate and just multiply that monthly income by 12, and then you'll an expected annual expense. And that's at that 30% of that adjusted average median income. Again, and this is for a two-person household. And this this slide is included in the PowerPoint in, I think it's the second to the last page. So then we look at what the general plan, what is the trigger for an inclusionary housing, for a project to fall into that inclusionary housing requirement. And that would be five, would have to be accommodating inclusionary housing in some sort. a single family dwelling is exempt, and then if you're 2 to 4, you end up paying an in lieu payment to the city to account for that inclusionary. So they're still subject to it. It's just you don't see it really on the ground for them.
Mm-hmm. Question, Commissioner Maynard.
Can you just clarify again the difference between the higher density zoning trigger of 20 or more units and the inclusionary trigger of 5 or more units, and how those two numbers are related?
So the state, Chair and Commissioners, state law just provides that at a density, if you're zoned for allowing 20 units or more per acre, yes, that you're deemed to be a suitable site for one of these affordable housing at the extremely low, very low, or low.
So if you had like 6 units, then you might not be able to have affordable housing, even though the inclusionary housing trigger went in? Sorry, I'm just trying to clarify.
Chair and Commissioners, so if you may have a half an acre lot. So when you, with that density, then you would be looking at the possibility of having 10 units on that site. So you are, and if you are proposing more than that, you would be subject to this inclusionary housing. If you had a quarter of an acre site that was zoned this, then you'd fall into that five, you potentially could have 5 units. But if you if you had something lower than that, even though you were zoned for a higher density, but you couldn't get that on there, you may not fall into this requirement of having them on that lot. It's very case specific, looking at the size of the parcel, how many potential, what you're zoned for, how many you're required to put on there, and then how many you're actually proposing. You may be utilizing density bonus and trying to get more than what the underlying zoning. Again, it's very case specific in that aspect, and I'm not sure if you have anything else to add on that.
So just to clarify, if I may, you're talking about putting them on site versus putting them off site. You're not talking about the number that would be required as a density, as a inclusionary number. You're talking about the fact that they would be on-site or off-site based on the zoning. Am I wrong?
Chair and commissioners, that the city will always prefer to have them located on-site. There are ways for a developer to possibly propose some on-site, or a mix of them on-site and off-site, or setting aside money for rehabilitating existing affordable housing that might be falling out of its term. There are a number of options within the inclusionary housing program. We went over those, and those are detailed much more clearly in the NZO. The general plan kind of provided the framework of the program, and then the NZO kind of laid out a stepwise process, always beginning with the preference of them being located on site.
So what does the zoning density of 20 acres per 20 units per acre, what does that require, or what is that, how does that make an application to this? How is that applied in what difference does it make, 20 units per acre?
So, Chair and Commissioners, if you're zoned for 20, if you have a 1 acre site and you're proposing 20 units on there, 20% of that would fall into the inclusionary housing. So you would have to provide at these levels that are specified in the general plan and now the NZO when adopted, those income categories.
Okay, so if you're at 10 units per acre, then what's the requirement?
Still 20%.
So what difference does the 20 units per acre make?
That's just, Chair and Commissioners, that's just the density. If it's zoned for that density, then you are considered to be a candidate for affordable housing.
But if we pass this, then it doesn't matter. Everybody's going to be required to provide the same percentage, no matter what the zoning is, if they have a certain size project. You know, if they have, 5 units per acre and they build on 5 acres, they build 25 units, 5 units would have to be affordable. Is that correct?
Chair and Commissioner, that's correct.
So, Chair and Commissioners, the 20 units or more per acre pertains, I think, in the first instance to the RENA planning process. So there's the long-range planning function of the housing element and the identification of key sites that absorb the housing need that's assigned to the City of Goleta. And then there's the individual consideration of specific projects on particular sites, and the 20% applies to projects on those sites. The density is what allows for the planning through the RENA process and the housing element.
You can proceed.
Thank you, Chair. So now we'll get into the discussion. So if the GPA is adopted, we want to just fully disclose what that is going to have, or what effect that would have on applications that are currently in process with the city. Again, the pending applications that are for housing with five or more would be subject to this GPA if adopted. The only exception to this would be if an application was deemed complete and it's subject to some other law, such as a vesting tentative map. I think we received a letter to that effect, and that letter was actually correct. That would be one of those exceptions where the GPA, if adopted, would not be applicable to them. But broadly speaking, projects that are in process, unless, you know, that other mechanism, they will be subject to this. Now, this could change the outcome to that developer, that if they were planning on, if it may not pencil out in terms of, you know, their investment and what their what their plans are showing, what their proposal, their environmental document, whatever stage they are in the process, they may need to go back and rewrite, revise their proposal, reanalyze, you know, the cost that they're going to be incurring. So just putting that out there.
Question, Commissioner Maynard.
A quick clarification question. With the zoning ordinance, there was a section related to vesting that gave some guidelines for what would have to adhere to the zoning ordinance should it be passed. And I know that is still a conversation at the city council level. Would the language around vesting in the new zoning ordinance also be relevant here?
Chair and Commissioners, so that was around a different aspect. While there's some overlap, if we adopt the GPA, that would not. I don't think it affects anything that we had discussed before, because those are all subject to the vesting for tentative maps. I believe those are all.
Chair and Commissioners, so there are two components here. The first is the general plan amendment, which you're considering tonight, and then the second part will be language in the new zoning ordinance that implements this general plan amendment. As to the second part, the vesting rules would apply to all new provisions of the zoning ordinance. So projects that are vested under the old rules would continue to apply, but going forward, the new zoning rules would not affect them. We would have to consider, because we have a general plan amendment, whether that affected a particular project, but that's not something that I think we've analyzed in detail.
Okay, on to the second bullet point. As we look at the last census, which the data are included in the general plan in the technical appendices, looking at the 2010 census, we see that at that time, 11,800 housing units were within the city. Approximately 6,300 of those are owner occupied, while approximately 5,500 are renter occupied. The vacancy rate on just combining those is approximately 5%. So great deal of demand in housing. when you look at what the affordability is for those, for both rental and ownership, there it was shown that they were both overpaying, with those that are overpaying for ownership, it was approximately $100,000 that it was shown that they were overpaying, with $200,000 for those that were renting. So it was a huge discrepancy. So it really exacerbated those lower income levels. Affordable housing obviously continues to be a very significant issue for the state, not just the city or Santa Barbara County. And housing policies within our general plan are reflecting that. That put a heavy emphasis on creating many different types of housing and many different forms of housing. So again, the NZO tried to incorporate those and codify how we reach those goals. So going to the current inclusionary requirements, as stated before, our primary goal is to get those to be constructed on site. The general plan does allow in-lieu payments. It does allow that rehabilitating of existing units, and those are really when building on site is determined to be infeasible. How that is determined to be infeasible is a discretionary action that is decided by either the Planning Commission or City Council, either on appeal, typically. Currently, if you look at housing element policy 2.5, it only relates to for sale units. And again, that was in response to Palmer. So we had taken that out, and those for sale units, and then the 2 to 4 units that are for sale get having that opportunity to pay that in lieu. If you look at the breakdown of the required affordable units, the 5% would be for extremely or very low, 5% for low, 5% for moderate, and then 5% for that workforce that we talked about earlier. In some opportunities, in some cases, a developer could make a request to reduce that 20% requirement down to 15%, and there are certain restrictions on locations on where that is not permissible. I believe the Hollister corridor was one of those that would not be permissible to have that reduction. Moving on to the effect that this GPA may have on NZO adoption. Currently, as I'm sure you are all very well aware, the NZO does not currently include rental inclusionary in any of the development standards within it. This is because the zoning code needed to match the general plan as written today. So currently, not having inclusionary apply to rental in the general plan means that currently the NZO doesn't either. So if there were to be a GPA that approved the rental inclusionary, the NZO text will also be amended, and depending on when the GPA is approved and how that looks, it may be folded in prior to adoption so that the City Council is looking at an NZO that does include that rental inclusionary, or if the GPA is adopted afterwards and how that looks, then we may end up revisiting the NZO if it gets across the finish line before the GPA does. So planning staff has contacted the state, HCD, and we've had a number of discussions with them on just exactly how this is going to affect our, if it will affect our certified housing element. So at first when we contacted them, we wanted to vet the inclusionary, just deleting out the for sale, the specificity of being for sale, not changing any of the inclusionary percentages, just making it so that it matched up, being applicable to both rental and for sale. They indicated that that in and of itself was not an issue. The first individual that we spoke with relayed that to us and then went up and verified that with his supervisor. We've received feedback from them that that narrow of a scope, that simple of an edit, just deleting out for sale, is within the scope of our prior analysis, and they wouldn't have an issue with that. And they'll be providing us a letter to that effect if that's where we stay and it goes to the city council with just that. Subsequent follow-ups. We had one earlier today with a supervisor at HCD, and what was indicated was whatever the Planning Commission recommends, we'll be revisiting with him tomorrow, and depending on what changes are being proposed, HCD will tailor a response letter accordingly. If there are changes to the percentages that were not analyzed before, we would need to do the proper analysis, and what the effect that would have on the GPA is really dependent upon the recommendation that comes out of the Planning Commission tonight. So again, we're able to do whatever we as a city wish to do. If we wanted to keep it at 10% for the lower income brackets, if we wanted to take it up to 15%, if we wanted to exceed that 15%, we have as a city the prerogative to do so. It's just what will then the subsequent analyses need to be, because HCD will want to see anything that exceeds that 10% for the lower income, because their concern is, are we introducing any new constraints on development? That if we go too high, we may constrain development in the future every level, actually.
Question, Commissioner Maynard.
So just to clarify, if we go through and we're just doing the one add as is in the staff report that just adds the word or takes out the word for sale, allowing it to be rental for sale, then it seems that it would actually be a 20%. So it would be for across all four categories and 10% in the two lowest categories. But we would be getting all four categories in the rental inclusionary housing?
Chair, Commissioners, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
I had a question. I understand HCD's concern. I didn't know if on the flip side, HCD expressed any feedback. I know we're going to get to this, but in looking at our current housing element period, it's proven to be very difficult to get some of the units in at the lowest levels. And my general understanding of some of the changes in state law is that HCD is going to be looking at that more closely. I just didn't know if there was any, if HCD expressed any concern about our current, where we are in terms of numbers of units created at the lowest levels, or if anything came up in that regard.
Chair and commissioners, there was no discussion on where we currently are with our arena, but the next housing cycle, we will be revisiting our new allocation, which should be coming out fairly soon, as well as all of the different changes in housing law that we will also need to comply with. So there'll be a complete full analysis. And at that point, if we're opening up the entire housing element, we could at that time revisit some of these numbers and the constraint, possible constraints, and what incentives, the various give and takes that the city and developers could work on.
Commissioner Maynard, did you have any more questions?
Thank you. So in your reading, if we went from, say, the 5% extremely low and 5% low to the 15% that's sort of written into AB 1505, that still would likely trigger further analysis since it'd be different than our original general plan? Or would it maybe not, because it is what's being recommended for maybe 1505?
Chair and commissioners, so that's a good question. So the AB 1505 is really, it sets that upper cap for jurisdictions that it'll be an automatic, you need to do, you know, some pretty significant analyses if you exceed that. That where we're sitting right now is at that 10%, and that concern is that space between 10-15%. Are we losing out on anything? That's what HCD would want. Any if we close that gap somehow, we will need to have done analysis. And did we introduce any new constraints? Are we still compliant with the analyses that we had submitted to them before? So it's not just that we get to increase that, and because we're below that 15% threshold of AB 1505, so it's a free pass in that sense. It's there still needs to be some analyses to substantiate any move in that 10%.
Chair and Commissioner Maynard, I wanted to add that we did speak with the supervisor at HCD today, and he did confirm that we're working from this certified housing element. They previously had not certified our housing element. So as it's written today, which was very different than how it's been written in the past, is what they analyzed to produce that much sought after certification determination. So that's what they're concerned about, is the analysis that they did that concluded in that certification, that they would have to revisit that. That's not to say that that couldn't happen. We're just disclosing that if we're to change the mix of the percentages and increase them, that's a conversation that we would have to have with the state.
So that concludes the discussion section. So I just refer back, as discussed in the staff report, this GPA is exempt pursuant to section 15061, which is known as the common sense exemption, where no effects would be created due to the adoption of this GPA. That concludes staff's presentation. Unless there's a specific question to either go back on anything or any new questions.
Let's see, Commissioner Maynard. No. Oh, Commissioner Sheeler.
Thank you, Chair. I do have a couple of questions. This is sort of a big change to our housing policy here, and I'm surprised that we've received very little feedback on this. The first thing that I saw was a letter dated today. I'm wondering about the noticing of something like this. I know we've talked a lot about noticing lately, and just wondering where particular projects in the city's pipeline, so to speak, your cumulative list of projects, were they particularly notified? What was the notification for this kind of change? Who found out about this, potentially?
Chair and commissioners, so those applicants that currently have an application in that would be affected by this, the current planning staff has contacted each one of those.
Do you have an idea of how many people are affected by this? Because I know certain people feel they are vested and therefore they're exempt from this. Of the cumulative projects list, do you know how many are actually impacted by this change? I guess they're considered pending and not complete.
Chair and Commissioner Sheeler, I did speak with the current planning manager about this. We looked at the cumulative projects list, and I believe there are only two pending projects that would potentially be affected at all by this. So it doesn't actually have particularly broad effect to currently pending permit applications.
Thank you for that. That's good information. Regarding the cells in terms of calculating eligibility, which is a complicated process in and of itself, under moderate, it says 80% to 20% of AMI, which is 50,000 to 76,000. That's kind of a large range potentially. Is the monthly rent the same for somebody making 50,960 versus 76,440?
I apologize. I'm not sure which slide you're referencing there. Okay.
It's based on the two-person house. There you go. So I'm looking at the moderate one, and then, which is 80 to 120%, and then it gives an income range that's calculated by that. And, you know, that's a 70, that's a $25,000 income range there. And I'm just wondering, is the monthly rent the same expectation for somebody at the very bottom of the range and somebody at the very top, or is it a graduated based on your income level? Exactly. That's what I was going to and wondering if.
So those kind of details are worked out after a project is approved and they go into a lottery and they do a selection process as far as exactly what somebody is earning and what the income range is. So they're based on the particulars of each project. But the range that you see in front of you is kind of a guide to use. So that gives you kind of the scale and the upper limit of what those income groups are. So we're providing you that information just for context so you can get a sense for when we talk about extremely low and very low all the way up to workforce, kind of what that means in terms of real dollars. But we weren't prepared to talk about the implementation side of it.
Okay, I think the implementation side, I don't know at what point that will be discussed because I know we're making recommendations to the city council. Hopefully maybe they will discuss this because it's important based on past practices and things that happened at a for sale project in Goleta as well, and just wanting to make sure that a developer, when given a list of eligible candidates, doesn't pick the person or the household that's making the most because they can exact the highest rent.
Commissioner Sheeler and Chair, we are working on an affordable housing resolution that would lay out some of the details of this. The city's past practice has been to charge the individualized pricing when it's a for sale situation and to charge individualized rental prices in rental inclusionary housing. When there's affordable units proffered by the developer, we do require the pricing to be individualized.
Thank you. And I did have one more question. What is the appeal path, or what would an applicant need to do to prove if their project can't pencil out to the 20% required affordable?
Chair and commissioners, that would be a case-by-case basis, and that would be something that an applicant would come in requesting and be providing the evidence themselves. It would need to be convincing enough if it came to the Planning Commission for 3/5 of you to accept.
And if I can add to that, what we're looking for is units, right? And so it's not always looking at the how much are they going to have to spend and how much do they need to earn. It's not always about that. If a developer can come in and say, I can buy these other units and it saves me a lot of money and I'm still getting you your 20%, or maybe I can get you 15% real units and convert those to affordable units, or these terms on these covenants are terming out and we're going to buy them down for another 45 years. We're looking for real units, and we're looking for the units as quickly as possible, and so are you when you're looking at housing projects. So those are the kinds of things that we're looking for. And then if we're going down to the on the payment side, in the past we've been pretty flexible working with developers, not asking for full economic studies, for example, but really working with them and working with the nonprofits in partnerships to seek projects like we have across the street at Village at Los Carneros, where we're getting some pretty amazing product for a lot of lower income people. So it's a pretty creative process in the way our housing element is set up, and then the new zoning ordinance will effectuate but I hope that gives you a little context.
I would also add that partnership with people self-help, these nonprofits, is really key in getting these actually to be located on the ground and in the city. So having developers that have built strong relationships, and as well as with the city, having strong relationships with them is really key.
I have to question if we, if we didn't recommend any changes and we maintained the status quo, and just for the record, I had asked some staff about some data on where we were in terms of units as it relates to RENA. But it's looking like at least through 2018 that we had zero units at the extremely low and very low levels. So if we're at zero or close to zero, and we didn't make any changes, and we continued at zero through 2022, and then we're looking at the housing element again, what's the impact, I guess, of not taking action, and if we're not able to get at these lower level units, does that then get sort of folded into the next round?
So the way it works right now is our housing element is certified, and that says through we've accounted the way we've needed to do our math and show that we've had lands available for the development of housing to meet this cycle. And then in our next cycle, we will provide a table similar to what we provided in your PowerPoint towards the end on RENA. You see that every year when we give you our annual progress report, because we give that accounting information with the backup to the state, to HCD, and they're looking at it. So they're looking at the viability of what we're producing based on what they certified. And things can change between now and the next housing element. But so far, we have met our expectation with our housing element, and these numbers will play into that next cycle if they're looking at what constraints we have and why we didn't produce it, and we'll have that conversation.
It's important to note that we have made progress in 2019, that a number of low and very low units have been completed, in particular at the Village of Los Carneros. So we'll have more numbers on that, and I don't know if we have any interim numbers that you want to share.
Chair and Commissioner, so yes, as Director Imhoff indicated, so 69 at the low were created in 2018 for Village of Los Carneros. So we did have a significant improvement on our numbers in that sense. As well as this past year, we've had a number of units that People Self-Help were renovating. There was an apartment complex in Old Town that had a net increase of 8 affordable units there. Additionally, last year, 2018, there were 12 ADU applications or permits that were issued and had received final occupancy. That was just issued. And then this year we've to date had 5 ADUs, so we're anticipating those to fall in there. And we've got many more pending applications for ADU. And then with the recent changes in state law, we're anticipating a good number more of those. Probably not enough to, satisfy those numbers, but they're definitely helping.
Commissioner Maynard?
Three quick questions, one comment and then three questions. One thing is just in terms of public feedback, I'll also note that though we didn't get a lot of public comment for tonight, I do remember through the zoning ordinance process, we did get consistent feedback about wanting to see rental housing be a part of our zoning ordinance and our inclusionary housing. I know just at the most recent city council meeting on the NZO, League of Women Voters talked about the importance of adding additional affordable housing units and moving into this rental direction. So I think we have seen some public comment in other settings around this as well. A couple of quick questions. Ms. Wells, you've talked about the importance of the coveted certification. Can you just talk a little bit about why it's important that we have a certified housing?
Well, at a practical level, having a certified housing element enables the city and developers and nonprofits to get grants to help fund housing projects. Mm-hmm. So that's the most practical answer. Mm-hmm. There's also statutory requirements and penalties and other things that are no fun.
Okay. And then, so as we talk about the RENA numbers, if we expand from for sale to rental, does that also increase our RENA expectation? Because now we're looking at at two sets, or is it the same numbers but could be achieved through either ownership or rental?
It's looked at as a tool. So the more tools that we have in our housing mm-hmm. element that aren't a barrier to construction mm-hmm. Are what we need to be able to meet our RENA obligation. We did meet our RENA obligation based on the zoning mm-hmm. and our vacant lands zoned minimum of 20 units per acre. So that's how we did that accountability. But in the future, for certainly every tool that we have will be necessary to align the RENA allocation mm-hmm. with what we're actually producing on the ground.
So, okay. So in other words, it's the second.
And then one last clarification, going back to vesting tentative maps for a second. So with the GPA, I understand, with the general plan amendment, I understand that the vesting tentative map would still hold that ability. And so this GPA would not affect somebody who has a vesting tentative map. If the zoning ordinance language goes through as is with the vesting language that we have, would that be counter to a vesting tentative map or the, okay.
Yeah. Chair, commissioners, no. So that vesting, the tentative map vesting rights that are given to a developer, that's state. So that would supersede anything that we would have in zoning or general plan.
Thank you for clarifying. That's all my questions.
Any other questions at this time from commissioners? Okay, I see none. Commissioner Sheeler.
I would like to follow up on that. So would that potentially that vesting be in perpetuity? So a project many, 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 many years later would not be subject to rental inclusionary? It would never time out?
Chair, commissioners, that would really be dependent upon the governor. Most times there is a sunset to how far out a map can go. But for instance, when Governor Brown, he signed many, many extensions. So vesting maps that were approved or pending, they had a very long life based upon the economic downturn. So that's really, it's dictated by the state. So we wouldn't really be able to answer that in particular. But that length of time could vary depending upon state concerns.
Any other questions? Okay, I see none. We'll go ahead and go to public comment. I have one speaker slip. I have Craig Minus. If you'll please come forward. You'll have 3 minutes to speak, and you'll see the little indicator lights in front of you.
Thank you, Chair Smith and member of the commission. My name is Craig Minus, and tonight I'm speaking as an individual. Although through my professional land use and housing affiliations, I feel I'm a fairly well-informed person on this subject matter. I'm concerned with the blanket approach at reapplying inclusionary on rental housing without better understanding its potential effects on housing production as a whole. I'm not against capital A affordable housing, and in many cases I'm in full agreement that we need to increase its production. However, imposing this inclusionary requirement on the market rate rental housing production without taking the time and effort to better understand the economic impact is very short-sighted. It shouldn't be the case that we merely rely on the previous general plan EIR analysis completed in 2006 to support the recommended inclusionary percentages. I'm almost positive there's been a number of economic influences that have changed over the past 13 years, and these have a direct effect on the feasibility of housing production. I'm worried that by not fully studying the economic impacts of inclusionary housing on market rate housing, we may not truly understand the impacts of this policy. What I'm worried about is that this such policy, while good intentioned, ends up squeezing the financial feasibility of market rate rental housing, such that the community gets a double whammy, being that no market rate rental housing is produced due to the inclusionary requirement, and therefore no inclusionary housing is produced either. The community ends up losing production of both types of housing. My last comment is on the CEQA exemption, and I'm not an expert in CEQA, but I've operated within it for some time. As suggested on page 5 of the staff report, I have a difficult time agreeing that this policy change has no possibility of having a significant effect on the environment. I'd actually argue the opposite. If this policy ends up halting housing production, then the housing availability continues to be challenging, leading more people to continue to sit on the freeways and drive to other areas where housing is more obtainable. All the while, they are bumper to bumper, and their exhaust continues to pollute our air. They continue to lose time to participate in church or shoot baskets with their daughters. I would argue that housing policy has a big effect on the environment. I would encourage your commission to further study the impacts of inclusionary housing on rental housing with the goal of getting it right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else who wishes to speak at this time? I see none. Thank you. Let's see, any follow-up from staff?
No, Chair, thank you.
Okay. Any questions from commissioners at this time? No questions? Okay, we'll go ahead and move into deliberations. Commissioner Fuller.
So I did provide, for the record, two articles, one of which is not very readable, but they basically are along the same lines that asking the developers to subsidize housing costs them and makes projects less feasible for them to do and or less profitable and reduces their incentive to do them, just as our speaker here pointed out. And the speaker has quite an extensive background in this, so I appreciated him coming forward with that. There are some in our community that would like that because they don't want to see more housing here. They don't want to see more growth. So I understand those people. There's people who want to see more affordable housing. But if these inclusionaries requirements have the effect of making it unfeasible, and developers do not have to build anything. There's no law that says that they have to construct something. So they can just choose to not do it. And then, as our speaker noted, there won't be any housing constructed as far as rental goes. In the lease case, we're going to have a modest impact to people not constructing it. We would have it marginally less, if nothing else. I had a thought this afternoon that might solve this situation. It follows the thinking that asking one particular group to provide a societal benefit is unfair and unjust. If this is a benefit to our society in general that we all agree to, then we should all bear the cost of this. It shouldn't be borne by one particular segment. This would be akin to requiring restaurants to serve 20% of their meals at affordable prices to people who then could afford them, including extremely low and very low, or to requiring attorneys to only bill 20% of their billing hours to very low and extremely low persons. So, it just doesn't make sense to ask one particular producer to bear what we believe is a good for society and to bear the cost of it. It should be borne by society and all citizens if this is what we think should be done. And there is already an avenue for this with Section 8. Section 8 already allows very low and extremely low people to obtain housing that's subsidized by the citizens in general. What we do have is a lack of people willing to accept Section 8. So the answer, I think, is to make this inclusionary requirement a requirement that a developer accept Section 8 for 20% of their housing. This way, they're not subsidizing it. They're actually getting market rates for their housing. We are paying for the subsidy. And we can even limit this to say that they have to take extremely low or very low. And they will have a much greater interest and incentive in allowing very low and extremely low occupants if they're being paid the full market rate. So this would then allow extremely low and very low people to have an opportunity to occupy a very nice new apartment. It won't cost the developers, so there's no disincentive for them to produce housing. We're basically, and society in general is paying for it. So it looks, I propose that this is a win-win-win. We get more construction of apartments. We don't have any holdback on that. We can tailor this more towards the extremely low, which would be very difficult for developers to do because there's costs involved that they're not going to recoup, that they're subsidizing. And we have society in general paying for it through Section 8. And I believe there's a big line of people, with Section 8's, potential Section 8's vouchers that just don't have places to go.
Commissioner Maynard.
I currently support the recommendation as staff has presented it to us tonight. Affordable housing is something that is very much needed here in our community. Many of the folks that work and spend their days here in Santa Barbara and in Goleta area, they're traveling to Santa Maria, Carpinteria, Ventura, and much farther locations to find affordable housing. In terms of traffic, I do see, I think the connection between environmental issues and housing is very closely linked. But I see right now a lot of the traffic that's on the highways is from renters that are going to far off areas to find rental housing that's not available in our area today. So I think if anything, this initiative would have a positive environmental impact instead of a negative one. In terms of Section 8 housing, I think there's a number of limitations that come up with Section 8 housing. The waiting list even to get into the Section 8 program at the statewide level is quite long. And so I'm not sure that that's the solution for us here today. Many other communities have very similar guidelines to this, and they still have housing being built. Individual projects may find that it is not feasible. However, other projects have come forward that have made it work. And so in looking at examples from across California, I think that this is a feasible, it is feasible as written, and I think a very smart move for our community. I would love to see, as we get into further analysis of the housing and we have a broader conversation around our housing element moving towards 2022, that we do consider increasing it up to the 15% allowable under AB 1505 for the two lowest income categories. But I understand the need to keep it at the current levels as staff recommended for today so that we can keep that certification of our housing element and be able to move forward with this quickly. We have needed this for so long, and I am so excited that staff heard us and heard the concerns that we brought forward and have really worked to figure out a way that we could potentially even see this in our new zoning ordinance if we could move forward with this quickly. If we try to change the percentages too much, I would worry that it wouldn't be able to be a part of our new zoning ordinance. And I'm excited to see the general plan amendment moving forward today. So I fully support staff's recommendation.
Yes, Commissioner Shields.
Thank you. Since we're sort of in comments and deliberations, I'll just go ahead and leave the last word to the chair. Just wanted to say, I think it is a legitimate, very legitimate question. Will this provide an undesirable effect on housing production? That's always a question that needs to be asked, particularly when you start making changes that may or may not necessarily be supported by the development community. Just another comment, market rate rental housing, and just to say market rate rental housing in Goleta is not affordable to most people who are commuting from North County or from the South. So that's not a solution to reduce vehicle miles traveled or greenhouse gas, is to provide more market rate rental housing for people that are commuting. Goleta has, as we all know, if we live here, has recently built a significant number of above moderate and market rate rental units. And it's unfortunate that the two largest rental projects that are on the horizon, which are the Heritage Ridge and the Cortona Apartments, will not be subject to inclusionary rental. So I'm looking forward further into the future of projects that are considered pending. I don't see this making a significant change in the near term. We'll see if those projects, if this goes through, will follow through on the permit path. Hopefully they will. That's it.
Yes, I would like to concur with the comments of Commissioner Maynard. I think our community and in our previous discussions regarding the new zoning ordinance, we're hearing from the community that they're concerned about affordable housing. As a practical matter, we're all experiencing the impacts and seeing those who are experiencing homelessness. We know that there's encampments in our community, people living on the streets, people who are unsheltered. And so we know that there's a desperate need for affordable housing in our community, and that those people are our residents. And we haven't, this is, I think, one tool. It is certainly not the only tool. And we know that there's other policies, funding, all sorts of things that need to be considered as part of this. But I think that this is one tool that can help us try to get some of those units at the lowest income levels. I don't think relying solely on Section 8 vouchers is practical. And I should note that even for most developments that are designated for low-income families and individuals, we as a society have also contributed in some way, whether through our taxes or in other methods and subsidies, that as a community we've sort of paid in and contributed for that. So it's in a slightly different way, but that does happen. So overall, I am concerned about what's going to happen in our community come 2022. If we don't quickly try to start addressing some of these units at the lowest levels, not only for just the practical reality of our most vulnerable residents, but we know at that time we're gonna need to address that issue. It's not gonna go away. So whether it's now or then, we need to start tackling this. And I think that an inclusionary policy as applied to rental is one tool in that toolbox to go about it. So as much as there's part of me that would love to consider something like 12% or playing around, I know that that would cause additional delays. So at this time, I would support the staff recommendation as proposed. Commissioner Sheeler, or any other comments?
I was just going to go ahead, and I guess we're ready to call the question and recommend that the Planning Commission adopt resolution number 19X in line, entitled Resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Goleta, California, recommending to the City Council approval of a general plan amendment to amend the city's housing element HE 2.5 inclusionary housing, and determine that the general plan amendment is exempt from CEQA pursuant to CEQA section 15061B3, and go with what the staff has recommended.
Is there a second?
I will second that.
A second from Commissioner Maynard. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Abstain.
One abstention. Okay, the motion passes with three, and we have one abstention and one member absent. Okay, our next item is the director's report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few things to report on. Upcoming agenda items of interest. The new zoning ordinance, which was heard on November 5th by the council, will go back to the council for continued consideration on December 3rd. At the Planning Commission's, at your commission's next meeting on December 9th, we anticipate having three items, a development plan and conditional use permit revision for a new synagogue, an updated ADU ordinance to comply with new state housing laws, and also the Goleta train station master plan. So we've got a full agenda on the 9th, if all those items do go forward as we expect. Also, we've got upcoming holiday closures. Next week, the office will be closed for Thanksgiving and the following Friday on November 28th and 29th. And then in December, for the December holidays, the office will be closed and City Hall will be closed from December 23rd through the 1st of the year, Wednesday, January 1st. More broadly, we've been doing a lot of work in the planning department and recognizing we have a number of new things that are on the horizon for us that are either already things we're grappling with or that are going to be coming soon. A lot of new stuff all at once. There's a whole new slate of state housing laws that took effect in October of this year that we're digesting and beginning to grapple with. We also, as you know, have the new zoning ordinance on the horizon, which is something that our staff will have to get familiar with and begin to implement, assuming it is adopted by our council in the near term. We also, just in the last few weeks, had a soft go live of our new permit tracking system internally. So we, at the staff level, especially the current planning division, is getting familiar with the permit tracking system, working out bugs, and making tweaks as necessary through our consultant. We anticipate that we'll have a public portal and a public go live sometime early next year, and we're very excited about that. That'll be a very valuable source of information for all members of our community. Along with that, we anticipate, depending on the exact action by our council, that we will have potentially new noticing rules for projects. We did take the NZO question about noticing for projects that would affect more than 1,000 residents to our Public Engagement Commission last week and got feedback from them, which we'll be reporting back to the council on December 3rd. So those are just some of the new things that are coming at us all at the same time, and there'll be a lot of learning, a steep learning curve to get up to speed on those and begin to implement them.
What was the date of that public engagement meeting?
Let me see. I believe, let me look on my calendar. I want to say last Wednesday, but as I mentioned, there's a lot going on. Yes, that was Wednesday the 13th.
Thank you. That seems like one I might want to watch.
Great. Well, that's very exciting to hear about everything that's going on behind the scenes. Thank you for sharing that with us. It's always good to hear more about sort of what's happening that we don't get to see while we're sitting up here. So thank you for that. Any other questions from commissioners? Okay. All right. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
Second.
So I have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We are now adjourned. Thank you, everyone.